when those families, if they're not being served well, can leave and take their money with them, then there's a much stronger incentive for the system to improve. It's sort of a feedback loop. And we do see that actually they do improve. So it's really quite the opposite. Those who are saying we really need to help the public system, well, the best way to help that public system is to give families more options to go somewhere else.
Welcome aboard. It is episode 46 of the J.R. Heff Show, and joining me on the podcast this week is Jason Bedrick. Jason is the Director of Policy for EdChoice, and he is joining us to talk about their organization, whose mission is to advance educational freedom and choice as a pathway to successful lives and a stronger society. With kids getting ready to go back to school or already back to school, this seemed like an appropriate time to have Jason on the podcast. And as the Director of Policy for EdChoice, he oversees 32 states. And of course, one of those would be Virginia. And so he talks about a lot of the policies and initiatives that EdChoice has. And Jason is a great guy to have on the program because he does have a master's degree in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And in order to get his degree, his thesis was Choosing to Learn, where he assessed the scholarship and tax credit programs operating in 8 states, including their program design. So Jason really knows what the heck he's talking about, and you will find that out rapidly as we go throughout the course of the podcast. And so without further ado, let's go ahead and get underway with Jason Bedrick. Jason Bedrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. You know, folks are starting to think about education, getting kids back to school, and a lot of folks are restricted by where they live. They're sending kids back to the public schools of the district of where they are. And education choice, school choice is your bailiwick. So talking about why that's important is pretty cool. So thanks again for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. And yes, you know, I was fortunate that my parents could afford to live in a district that had really great public schools. Unfortunately, not everybody has access to a school that meets their needs. We have a system that's really a holdover from a previous era, you know, the industrial era, when, you know, it made sense because of limitations in communications and transportation that you would just send all the children in one particular geographic area to one school. But that really doesn't make sense in the information age, and we really need to move toward a system where children have access to a wide variety of schools so that parents can choose the school that best meets the needs of their individual child's particular, you know, needs.
So, Jason, you're the Director of Policy for EdChoice. This organization, from my research, has been around about a decade. And again, it's trying to educate and empower communities in order to, you know, give kids an opportunity for greater education. But before we dive into a lot of the policy-related questions that I have regarding education, how did you get involved in this? So you have a very interesting background that I've looked at. How did you get to be Director of Policy? Let's go from there. You talked about your education as a kid, but guide us through how you got interested in this subject.
Yeah, I really got interested in the subject in college. I had I was doing a paper for a political science class where I was studying education and trying to figure out how could we create a more fair and equitable system. What really troubled me was that I believe this country is based on the premise of equality of opportunity, and you really can't have quality of opportunity if you don't have wide access to high quality schools. So there was a bill in the New Hampshire state legislature, my home state at the time, which which it was going through the legislature and it was going to expand school choice options, and it failed by a vote of 171 to 172. And I couldn't believe that it failed by just one vote. I ended up even running for office trying just on that issue. But that was really my introduction to the school choice movement. I read about Milton Friedman and his idea that, you know, there might be an argument that we need the government to subsidize education because not every family can provide, they don't have the resources to provide their child with a quality education. That's, you know, that's the assumption. And therefore, we as a community, given that we live in a representative democracy, if we want to continue to do that, we need to have an informed populace, and therefore it's in everybody's interest that every child has access to an education. But Friedman's insight was that it does not then follow that the government has to be the one that also runs the schools, that it would be much better to leave that to the private sector and allow families to choose among a variety of different options, which one best meets their needs. So that's really where I got my start in the movement. And, you know, here more than a decade later, I now am the director of policy at the organization that Milton Friedman founded with his wife, Rose Friedman, in the 1990s to work toward advancing educational choice for all.
You mentioned something there that's important. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys on the podcast is because the concept of opportunity for all and educational choice has come up in a couple of my other podcasts where you would not expect them necessarily to come up. One was in terms of housing integration, where folks are obviously limited in terms of their education choice by where they live. And not necessarily having the opportunity to break through some barriers that are put in front of them. And then by that same token, there are people who are making life decisions, specifically in terms of whether to have a child or not, based upon the future that that child might have because of the limitations of where they live. Does that come into your forefront in terms of your thinking, in terms of why you advocate for the policies that you do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, people say there's already a market for education. It's called the housing market. You know, if you can afford the expensive house in the expensive area with high taxes, and then you have access to a better school. And if you can't afford that kind of living arrangement, then by and large, you don't. We really need to break this link between education and housing. The home that you're able to afford should have no bearing on the education that your child has access to.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was talking to my wife too. She's a former educator. She taught physics for a while, and now she's in industry. And one of the things that she wanted me to ask you in terms of, are we preparing, obviously, our kids for what industry needs? Are the public schools doing a good enough job at getting the skill sets that are needed in order to make sure that America has a vibrant economy? How does educational choice fall into answering that question?
You know, it is really difficult to say, and it varies considerably by region. Certainly, you see lots of industry experts saying that they're, you know, in certain areas that they simply, the public schools are not producing enough students that have the skills for their industry, and so they're going overseas to find students that are more adept at STEM, you know, the science, technology, engineering, and math skills that they need for their particular industries. And I think one of the problems, too, is we have this push of college for all, and that there are a number of students at the margin who, in some cases, might be better off going to a trade school. You've got welders that are making figures in some cases. You've got all of these just like machinist-type jobs that are unfilled. They could be filled if these students go to trade school. Instead, some of them are pushed into going to college, and they don't finish. And the problem there is that they end up with all of the debt, you know, that they took on, but without the diploma. And without that degree, they don't have access to the higher paying jobs that they were trying to train for, but they also don't have the skills to go into some of those other trades. So I do think that there is a bit of a mismatch there. And for some students, absolutely, obviously, college is a great thing, but we shouldn't look down on the trade schools, and we do need to do a better job of teaching students that high school students in particular, that this is an honorable option and an option that can provide them a high standard of living as well, and that they should consider it when they're thinking about their future.
You know, sometimes I do this in my podcast where I start jumping to the questions on the deep end of the pool without covering some of the basics first. I think maybe we need to circle back a little bit. What's interesting to me is, all well and good, but let's talk about what educational choice is. Let's start at the basic level. You know, some people might say, well, this is just the opportunity to choose to go to a private school if you want to go to a private school. What is educational choice? What does that encompass?
It certainly encompasses a wide variety of things, right? So there's inter-district choice, where somebody goes to a district school that is outside of their residentially zoned district. There are charter schools, which are a form of public school that is privately managed. They're secular. They're not allowed to have admission standards. So if there's oversubscription, they have to have a lottery. And then they're exempt from some of the state accountability rules. So they have a little bit more flexibility, but they still are accountable with the state test. But then there are forms of private school choice. And so really there are three major forms. There's Milton Friedman's original idea of a voucher, and he wasn't really the one to originate it, but he was the one to popularize the idea. A voucher is just where you're taking a portion of the state funds that was allocated to your child and taking them with you to a private school of your choice. I say the state portion. It's important for your listeners to know there are, generally speaking, three main sources of revenue for district schools. State, local, and federal. Federal is usually less than 8% of the total, and the remainder is split, depending on the state, sometimes about 50-50 or two-thirds, one-third in one direction or the other between state and local. In some states, it's mostly local dollars. In others, it's mostly state dollars. But you would get a portion of the state funds following the child. All of the local and federal funds stay with the district school. Virginia is one of 18 states that has a tax credit scholarship program. So that's a little bit different. Here we're dealing with private dollars, not public dollars. The individual and or, depending on the state, corporate donors make contributions to nonprofit scholarship organizations. Those scholarship organizations, they get a tax credit. And the tax credits range in value, depending on the state, from about 50% to 100% of the contribution. And then those nonprofit scholarship organizations help low and middle income families attend the school of their choice. But the third, and I think the most interesting form of educational choice, is the education savings accounts. And these should not be confused with similar ESAs or similarly sounding ESAs, like the 529 plan or the Coverdell ESA, which are about saving for college. These education savings accounts are more akin to health savings accounts. So what I mean by that is this. Like with the voucher, you're going to take a portion, usually about 90% of what the state would pay for your child. But instead of being given in the form of a voucher, which is just a coupon, you get a restricted use bank account. Now, this bank account can only be used for a limited number of educational purposes. So private school tuition is one of them, but also things like tutoring, textbooks, homeschool curricula, online courses, and you can even roll it over any unused funds to save for future years, or even if there's any left over at the end of the child's senior year, they could then use it for college. So this is really moving from school choice to educational choice. It's thinking outside of the four walls of what we traditionally call school and empowering families with a much greater degree of freedom and flexibility when it comes to tailoring their child's education.
Now, I'm glad that you brought that up, because here in Virginia, when Governor McAuliffe was still our governor, he actually vetoed parental choice education savings accounts. This was a bill that was sponsored by Delegate Dave LaRocque of Loudoun. And the governor's response to this, he said that the savings accounts would divert state funds from public schools and redirect them to educational services outside the public school system. I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to talk about that specific piece of legislation, but I bet you hear that argument a lot, where, you know, the general argument is, well, we can't do these educational choice programs because they're going to undermine what we have already in place in terms of, you know, ensuring that there is quality public education across the board.
Right. And I think first things first, are the students made for the system, or is the system made for the students? I don't think that children are mere funding units for the existing system. The system is made for them, and this is really expanding our definition of public education by including all sorts of other options that these students really should have access to, as opposed to this system, again, that was built for a previous era and has, in some ways, outlived, I don't want to say outlived its usefulness, because obviously they provide a value to the community, but it no longer makes sense that this is the only way that we're going to support children getting an education. We should be trying as a society to make sure that children have access to whatever works best for them, because ultimately that's best for all of us. But secondarily, I think it's also important to note, again, all of those local funds stay with the local school, all of the federal funds stay with the local school, and only a portion of the state funds are following that child out the door to go to the school or learning environment of the family's choice. And so these programs save the taxpayers money. And it's also important that we know that there are fixed and variable costs, right? So The other side will say, oh, this is going to hurt the school because all these students are going to leave, the money's going to leave, and then we're not going to have money to educate those children. Well, tends to be that the local funds actually cover all of those fixed costs, and the state funds usually are covering the variable costs. So when that child is leaving the system, the expenses associated with that child are leaving the system as well. And really, this should be showing up if it were true that the public system, that as we know it, is harmed by giving families choice, then it should show up somewhere in the research literature. But there have been more than 24 studies conducted in different states that have forms of school choice to see what is the impact on the district schools after the introduction of a school choice program. And all of them find neutral to positive, most of them are positive, modest but statistically significant, positive effects on student outcomes for those students that are still in the district school system. Which is to say that once there is more choice and competition, the district schools respond by improving their performance, which really shouldn't be something that's unexpected. We see this across the board. When you have a monopoly, then, you know, there's the concept of the lazy monopolist, right? They don't have to be as responsive to the needs of the customer. But when there are other alternatives, when those families, if they're not being served well, can leave and take their money with them, then there's a much stronger incentive for the system to improve. It's sort of a feedback loop. And we do see that actually they do improve. So it's really quite the opposite. Those who are saying we really need to to help the public system. Well, the best way to help that public system is to give families more options to go somewhere else.
So talk then about why politically this does not catch fire among both political parties. It would definitely appear that the advocates for school choice have a tendency to be the conservative party, tendency to be Republicans, and that those who are opposing it tend to be Democrats. Now, I understand that EdChoice is a nonprofit and a nonpartisan organization, but clearly you can observe that the tendency to oppose your policies come from the Democrats. And so, you know, why, number one, why is that? And number two, what is EdChoice trying to do in order to convince Democrats that this actually isn't trying to undermine, say, public sector unions or teacher unions?
Well, certainly, and I would note, yes, we are a 501c3 nonprofit. We also have a tremendously diverse staff ideologically. There are Republicans, there are Democrats, there are even libertarians in the staff. All of us united on one thing, which is that all children deserve access to the education that best meets their needs. And actually, if you look at the polling, and I think the best polls on this are conducted by Education Next. They have an annual survey. Education Next is affiliated with Harvard University's program on education governance. And they release an annual survey. And actually, they find that majorities of Republicans and Democrats and independents support school choice. So in terms of your, you know, rank and file average voter, they tend to be in favor of it. The question is sometimes the parties. And I think you're right that generally speaking, historically, the Republican Party has been, at least initially, more supportive than the Democratic Party. Although it's also true that some of the greatest champions of school choice were Democrats. The first voucher program that was passed in this country was sponsored and championed by a black Democrat, Polly Williams, in Milwaukee. And she saw that the public schools were not serving her community well. You know, and it was a, you know, her district was a majority-minority district. And, you know, she saw that children in the black community were not given access to high-quality schools. And so she and civil rights activist Howard Fuller and others joined forces with some members across the aisle to pass that bill. Likewise, in Florida, you know, initially it was Jeb Bush who was pushing school choice and the Republican Party. But over time, the Black caucus and the Hispanic caucus, which are mostly Democratic, also became big supporters because it was members of their community that were benefiting the most. Now, school choice, I believe, benefits everybody, but obviously the ones that benefits the most are the ones that are having the least access to choice right now. And that tends to be those who are minorities, tends to be those who are low income. And therefore, it's no surprise that polling consistently finds the highest levels of support among low-income families and among black and Hispanic families. So, you know, there are forces, you know, the existing public school establishment and particularly the teachers' unions that has lots of power, lots of money, and they have thus far, I think, done a good job, so to speak, of blocking these reforms. But really, they're only slowing them down. And in the long run, I mean, put it this way, there is not a single school choice program in the country that has been repealed after it has been enacted. And currently, there are 29 states plus D.C. that have some form of school choice, usually small programs limited to students with special needs or low-income students in a particular area. But none of them have been legislatively repealed because once families have access to choices, they're not going to let some politician take it away from them. And so in states that do have school choice, you see growing bipartisan support, and that's what I expect to see over time.
You know, it's been a long time since I wrote a paper on school choice, at least a decade. So forgive me for, perhaps an uneducated question here. But the point being, we have had these test cases in communities like Milwaukee, in Florida. Have we seen any negative impacts to unions on having school choice in a community? Do they have a reason for opposing school choice?
I mean, their reason is primarily that if students are going somewhere else, then...
Well, I'm saying we have data now.
Yeah.
So is there sufficient data that says, yeah, teachers lost their jobs?
I don't know of data that shows that teachers lost their jobs. But I think, again, that the more salient question is, well, what's been the impact on the students? And as I noted before, the research shows a neutral to positive effects. So that's on the students who stay behind. There's even more evidence. Most of the randomized controlled trials, which is the gold standard of social science research, find positive impacts on the students that are participating in the program as well. So I think it's very important. And we don't want to make school choice about test scores. It's obviously about a lot more than just test scores. But what evidence we do have does show positive effects on test scores, and especially long run. There are a few negative studies, but those are outliers, and mostly have to do with Louisiana, which has an overregulated program that maybe we can get into on another day. But most of the studies are positive on the test scores, and also in terms of high school graduation and college matriculation. So there are some long-run positive impacts on these students as well. And the strongest positive effects are on students that were in the program for the longest.
In general terms, do we have faith in the American family to make good choices? I mean, should the education of a person, I mean, where I'm going with this is we look back at maybe the history of the educational system, and part of the reason why we have a broad scope educational system is because kids were not getting educated, because there wasn't an opportunity for people to, learn the basics, or they weren't going to the schoolhouse or what have you. And so education had to be mandated. We had truancy laws, right? And so the whole concept of school choice is predicated upon parents wanting the best for their kids and to make good decisions. And so, I mean, I would argue that the answer is, of course, yes, parents will make good choices. But, what do you think needs to be done in order to ensure that the decision makers are properly informed on what their options are?
Yeah, I think there is a certain element of paternalism in that regard. And actually, some of the assumptions that we have about the origins of the common school system are faulty. So, for example, a British social scientist, E.G. West, discovered that rates of literacy in the United States were actually higher before the introduction of common schools. But this is not to say that parents are never going to make mistakes. But the truth is bureaucrats make mistakes as well. So really the ultimate question is which form of system has the incentives aligned to produce the best outcomes most of the time. And Milton Friedman talked about four different ways that you can spend money. So you can either spend your money or someone else's money, and you can either spend that money on yourself or on someone else. When you're spending your own money, you have a strong incentive to economize, and you don't if you're spending someone else's money. If you're spending money on yourself, you have a strong incentive to maximize the value you get. And when you're spending on someone else, the incentive is not as strong. The district school system is basically people spending other people's money on other people. You don't have a great incentive either to economize or to provide value, to maximize your value. So it's no surprise then that we see over the last several decades, even adjusting for inflation, a more than tripling of the amount that we're spending per pupil. And yet on the NAEP score, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, which is known as America's report card, for 17-year-olds, over the last four decades, it's been flat. And so we're, as you would predict from Milton Friedman's framework, you have incredibly rising costs, and at the same time, you don't have an increase in the value that's being provided. Vouchers, you're still spending other people's money, but at the very least, you're spending it on yourself, so there is that greater incentive to economize. And then with the education savings account, even though it's dollars that are being deposited from the state into your account, you can really treat that money like your own, because unlike a voucher, which again is a coupon that you can spend in one place at one time, with the ESA, it's not just one private school, and it's not just private schools competing against each other. They're competing against tutors. They're competing against homeschooling. They're competing against online courses. And you can put that money in a whole bunch of different places. And then they're also competing against future savings, because you know you want to save for later because high school is more expensive, or you want to save for college. So you can treat that money like your own. So those families also have an incentive to maximize their value. So if you're talking about what form of system is going to align incentives to produce the best outcomes in general, then certainly a system that gives parents more freedom and flexibility to choose what's best for their kids, and really who knows a particular child's needs better than their parents, that's the kind of system you want, one that empowers parents.
Yep. Let's circle back, though, to, you know, kind of expand on that question a little bit and use the Virginia Education Improvement Scholarship tax credit thing that we were talking about before as sort of a baseline. That bill passed and went into effect for people in 2013. And if you look at the chart here that you guys provide on your website through 2017, you see, you know, a typical staircase effect where it grows year after year after year after year. Okay, so it's certainly improving, certainly growing, but I'm not sure the average Virginian parent is aware who is covered by this. Who can compete for it, it's widespread availability. So what is the motivation, and who is responsible for conveying information regarding opportunities like the Virginia Education Improvement Scholarship? And is there kind of a critical mass that needs to take place in order to, you know, allow school choice to happen?
Yeah, I certainly think that once it hits a tipping point, once there is a critical mass, then people are much more aware of the options once you have a certain number of people, because unfortunately right now it's mostly being spread by word of mouth. Government doesn't do a great deal to inform parents of their options. Generally speaking, you've got these scholarship organizations. They're doing their best. There has been tremendous growth in the state. The first year that it was in effect was in 2013, and there are only about 50 students that were participating. Last year, there were more than 3,200 students that were participating, but that's still a tiny fraction of the student population. The largest program, similar program in the country, actually the largest private school program, period, is in Florida, where more than 100,000 students are participating. And if you add up all of the different programs, private school programs, more than 5% of the population are attending some sort of a private school program. When you include charters and interdistrict choice, both in Florida and in Arizona, there's more than 50% that are attending a school outside of the residentially assigned school. So there are certain states that are hotbeds for choice, and parents get into the habit of, you know, before they enroll their child in first grade or even kindergarten, they're thinking about the different options that are in their area. They're turning to certain scholarship organizations, Step Up for Students in Florida. In Arizona, you've got Arizona School Choice Trust, which runs a program called Choose a School. Looking at the different information about schooling options in their state, but there's a great deal of inertia where people are accustomed to choosing a school system when they purchase a home. And unless they have, you know, some particular religious reasons, or there's a, you know, they know that their school system just isn't that good, or they go into the system and they find that it's not working for their child for whatever reason, only then do they start looking for options. But in higher choice environments, it becomes, it's not just about the status quo. You know from day one, you've got options, and so you explore them.
So edchoice.org is where folks need to go to find out more about your organization and about the conversation on school choice. It's a wealth of information with not only your own research and plenty of, you know, really good, get your fingernails dirty kind of information out there for folks. So more than enough for folks to get educated on the topic. But where do you see right now where do you see school choice right now today as a policy topic, and where do you see it going into the future?
You know, we've had tremendous success in recent years in enacting new programs. Six states now have an education savings account. It started in Arizona. Florida was the second state. There are now ESA programs for students with special needs in Mississippi and North Carolina and Tennessee. Nevada also has a universal ESA that, unfortunately, due to the confluence of a lawsuit and a change in the state legislature, is constitutional and on the books, but not funded. But those are six states that have ESAs, and more than two dozen last year were looking at them. So I think we are hitting a tipping point. Early on, you had a lot of scaremongering. You know, people would say, oh, well, this has never been tried, and what's going to happen, and the public school system is going to collapse. But the reality is that two of the states that are the fastest improving are also the states that have the highest choice environment. So that would be Florida and Arizona. When I say fastest improving, I mean on the NAEP that we discussed earlier. So the public school systems in these states are not only not falling apart, as the naysayers predicted, but are actually tremendously improving. And so I think that central argument that the other side uses, which is this fear that it's going to destroy the public school system, is not only unfounded, but actually quite contrary to the evidence. So as the populace learns about this and says, well, hey, you know, our neighboring state has school choice for their kids. Why can't we have school choice for our kids? It's only a matter of time before these programs really sweep the nation.
So, Jason, one of the things that I like to do at the end of my podcast is ask the people who come on the show who are highly accomplished in their own right, and you certainly are one, as director of policy for a national organization. You got a master's degree from Harvard. I want to find out what motivates you. What are you inspired by? What sort of words of wisdom do you have for my audience?
Oh, I wasn't prepared to offer words of wisdom today, but in terms of what inspires me, it's really the kids. You know, in my travels, and I've been to, you know, dozens of states, especially since joining EdChoice, and I've testified in front of a bunch of different state legislatures and met so many families that tell their school choice story, you know, why it is that they're desperate to have school choice, or in other cases, what a blessing it was that they were able to exercise school choice because of the availability of one of these programs in their state. So it's really remembering those families. I'll just give you one example that comes to mind recently. In New Hampshire, there was a boy who, an African-American child in a school that's 99% white, and he was deciding to take a knee during football games. Now, whether you agree politically with his statement or not, he was bullied because of that tremendously. And he was had death threats against him. And so no matter our politics and no matter what we think about his choice, I think we can all agree that he was taking a stand for something that he believed in, which is a courageous thing, and that no child should be the subject of bullying or death threats. The school was unable to take care of him and so or stop the bullying. So his family tried to move to a different they had a single mom. She couldn't just move to another district, but she was sending her child to a private school after that, scraped together some funds, asked for something there that's called material hardship, where in some cases if one school can't meet a child's needs, the public funds can follow the child to a different district school. But she wanted her child to go to this private school, and the state said, absolutely, no way, those funds are not going to follow your child to the private school. She was able to get a scholarship through the scholarship organization in that state because they have a program that's very similar to the one in Virginia. So she was able to exercise school choice and get her child out of a bad situation into a better one. I don't ever want a situation where a family has to keep sending their child to a school where that child's being tormented, or even just where that child is not receiving quality education because they don't have any alternatives. So in terms of, you know, what gets me up in the morning and why am I so excited and passionate about this issue, it really is because it comes down, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, to the American promise of equality of opportunity. And if we truly believe in that, then we really need to reform our education system to reflect it.
Jason Bedrick is Director of Policy for EdChoice. Jason, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That'll do it for another episode of the J.R. Heff Show. Special thanks again to Jason Bedrick of EdChoice for coming on the program. Again, you can find out more about them at edchoice.org. As far as websites go, don't forget that you can catch this episode and all the others at jrheft.com. You can follow me on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at jrheft. And consider joining our Facebook conversation group. On that group, you can leave your comments and your thoughts and anything else that is of interest to you and the larger group. You're the one controlling your posts, so we would love to catch your thoughts throughout the course of the week. Shoot me an email with your thoughts on this program and any other comments at jrheft@jrheft.com. Finally, don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and the TuneIn Radio app. We are working on Spotify. Hopefully that will be completed here soon. But search for the J.R. Heft Show and rate and review the program. That certainly helps and is a great way to show your support. Just listening shows your support. Thank you very much for all of that. Until next time, this is J.R. Heft. It's Liberty Call.